When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. I'm going to be talking a little bit today about Harold Wilson's Labour government in Britain from 1964 to 1970, during the period that we tend to classically think of, and I cringe to use the term, the swinging 60s in Britain. And we're going to look a little bit about the projection, the artifice of Wilson's government, and then the economic realities behind it. And that kind of explains why by the end of the decade, really many of the supposed dreams of the 60s really have gone unrealised. So the 1964 election saw the downfall of the Conservative government, which had been had four prime ministers, Churchill, Eden, Macmillan and Alec Douglas-Hume, of which Macmillan was by far the most successful. And 13 years of Conservative rule had seen a dramatic transformation in British society. The Conservatives adopted a largely centre-ground approach to politics, to society and to the economy. They agreed with Labour that there should be a commitment to full employment in Britain, and that there should be a mixed economy, a large proportion of it nationalised. And so this is the high point, really, the 50s and 60s, the high point of what was known as the consensus era of British politics. For their part, the Labour Party was not dominated by the left. And really, the extremes of the left of the Labour Party really manifest themselves in any great sort of sense in the 1970s under likes of Tony Benn. So you have a fairly broad consensus economically and socially about about Britain, but this is a fairly expensive consensus. There are two huge spending commitments that both Conservative and Labour governments never really managed to successfully afford. The first spending commitment is the growing welfare state, but this pales into insignificance compared to the vast amount spent on defence, and particularly Britain's overseas obligations and colonial possessions. Even though Britain had lost India and from the late 1950s onwards was in the business of decolonising in Africa, she still spent an awful lot, far more than she could afford, something like about 22% of gross national product, on on maintaining an army in Germany as part of NATO, and also maintaining bases east of Suez, so places like Aden and Singapore and Hong Kong. These again are huge, huge expensive spending commitments, and ones which later on under Heath were seen as increasingly unjustifiable and unsustainable. When Wilson enters office, he appoints James Callaghan as his Chancellor of the Exchequer, and the two of them uncover a Tory horror story. Reginald Maudling, the previous Chancellor of the Exchequer, decided to go on something of a spending spree before the 1964 election, believing that that an injection of spending into the economy could kind of kickstart the economy. There had been a problem, an ongoing problem, throughout the 50s and early 60s of what was known as stop-go, of allowing the economy to boom, as it naturally tended to do under such fortuitous conditions of world trade in the 1950s and 60s, and then when inflation started to tick up to unacceptable levels, to turn on the interest rates and to slow down the economy and stop it. The problem, the question of inflation in the 50s and 60s is not one that bothers governments of either stripe particularly, in that the overall objective that most British governments, up until really the Callaghan government of the last part of the 1970s onwards, up until then, all governments believed that it was okay to tolerate a certain amount of inflation in return for full employment. And with unemployment for most of the 60s being under 1%, under 2%, that was, you know, in that view of things, in a commitment to full employment sense, a successful policy. So the problem that Wilson has when he comes to office is that because of conservative economic policies under the previous government, and a certain degree of recklessness, perhaps from a government that knew that the failure, that being voted out was inevitable anyway, that there isn't the money to pay for the amount of social reform that Wilson's promised, to honour Britain's defence commitments, and to keep the pound strong. On the final issue of the value of the pound, this is something that was very dear to Wilson's heart. In 1924, Ramsay MacDonald, the first Labour Prime Minister, was forced to devalue the pound. And Labour was seen as the party of devaluation. And whilst devaluation is not a particularly bad idea, it actually allows exports to flow out far easier, and it's something that business really quite favours. The point about devaluation, and this is why during the 1920s Winston Churchill puts the pound on the gold standard and keeps a constantly an artificially high value for the pound, is it devaluation tends to favour industry at the expense of the finance of the City of London. And it also is seen as a kind of a national retreat, an acceptance that the pound is no longer popular, or the pound is no longer a currency that people wish to invest in. And that acceptance is almost like, you know, in cultural and political terms, an admittance of defeat and the decline of the British economy. This is something that Britain's political classes have found it very difficult to tolerate. And they've also, there's this accusation that the Labour is the party of devaluation, something that doesn't sit right in the newspapers either, and creates for Labour this aura of bad economic management. So it's not something that Wilson is happy to embrace at all. And the advice from the Treasury in 1964, when looking upon the books, was that there are a number of stark choices ahead. You either slash your spending commitments and let down the working class voters that have voted for more social reform, pensions, housing, that sort of thing. Or you reduce the amount of overseas commitments that Britain has. Again, you present Britain with a picture of being, or the Labour Party with a picture of being unpatriotic, willing to retreat in the face of the communists and Russia and the Cold War and all that sort of thing. Or you devalue. You have to take one of these unpalatable choices. And Wilson chooses to take none of these. And one of the things that characterises Wilson throughout his time in office, and then his second period of office from 1974 onwards, is a refusal to take hard choices. The consequences of refusal by Wilson to accept, you know, hard economic medicine, actually, compared to what the country has to accept in the 1970s, it's comparatively minor, is a gradual decline in the British economy and a gradual decline in British economic confidence throughout the 1960s. Many of the visions that Wilson has for Britain, he talks about Britain being transformed in the white heat of technology, he talks about Britain being a modern, classless meritocracy, this technocratic society that will be built under kind of modern architecture and technology. All that sort of thing is unaffordable by the late 1960s. Instead, the kind of the visions that Wilson projects in about 64 become distinctly dystopian by the end of the end of the decade. The sense that the new towns that are being built, that tower blocks that are being put up, that educational changes are leading to quite a kind of dark, chaotic society is prevalent for many people. Now, of course, this isn't exactly or even nearly the case. Britain actually was in many ways a better place by the end of the 1960s. There had been reforms to the law on divorce, reforms to the law on abortion, reforms to the law on capital punishment, hanging had been ended, reforms to decriminalisation of homosexuality, there had been the development of the Open University. By the end of the 1960s, more working class people than ever before were going to university, and there was more social mobility by the end of the 1960s and into the 1970s than there had ever been or would ever be again. So there were some great things to be said about Wilson's years, but the fact is that they become frighteningly unsustainable, and both Heath and then Wilson again and then Callaghan all inherit the problems of the 1960s, not least of which is Northern Ireland, which is such a huge issue that I'll focus on that another time. The problem of Britain's trade unions and trade union reform, again, is something that is fudged by Wilson. From the end of 1968, Barbara Castle is tasked with Wilson with the job of reforming the trade unions and drafting trade union reform law. She spends much of December at the Sunningdale College in Ascot with the civil servant with her civil servants drafting up the In Place of Strife legislation, which had some fairly moderate proposals, such as a cooling off period and a consultation process before any more strikes took place. The problem that had been, of course, is that strike days had gradually increased throughout the 50s and 60s. The problem with strikes in Britain was nowhere near as acute as in nearly all of Britain's other first world neighbours. Britain had become synonymous with strikes in the 60s and 70s. But actually, if you look at the track record of Canada, Australia, America, Italy, France, Belgium and Germany, in all those countries, strikes are actually worse. So part of the problem with strikes and the trade unions is very much flammed up by the broadsheet and the tabloid press, particularly the Times. But the proposals that Barbara Castle puts forward to limit union powers to strike and to try to create some kind of reasonable balance between the rights of workers and the needs of industry are sabotaged by Jim Callaghan, who is an ardent union man through and through, and whose power base is with the unions, which is ironic considering what they do to him from 1976 onwards. And the Prime Minister, Wilson, is more than happy to listen to Callaghan as he sees Barbara Castle's star in the ascendancy and sees her popularity growing. His fear is of a minister who might be able to challenge him for the leadership. One of the things about Wilson, who was described by one of his cabinet as the Yorkshire Walter Mitty, is that he was extremely suspicious by the later 1960s and extremely paranoid of his cabinet colleagues, and was happier in many ways to sabotage legislation or sabotage the people he worked with in a bid to preserve his own position. I think eventually, sadly for Wilson, his own career and his own position become more important to him. And on the subject of things that were important to Wilson, I think another thing that's true about Wilson is that he cannot be described, even in the days when there was a kind of a real spirit of socialism within the Labour Party, democratic socialism, I don't think Wilson can be described as remotely socialist at all. And certainly he didn't describe himself in those terms. He described himself really as an arch pragmatist, and he believed in doing what worked. He was probably an egalitarian. He believed that in social equality and fairness, and had sort of working class, or perhaps you might say lower middle class roots. But he was no ideologue in any way, shape, or form. He was extremely patriotic, one might even say slightly insular and nationalist, and wasn't very very enthused by the idea of joining the European Economic Community. Instead, he was a royalist. He believed in perhaps more stronger relationships with the Commonwealth, and was a kind of the left's answer, really, to the Daily Mail Little Englander. His attempts to portray himself as working class, smoking a pipe, drinking a pint of bitter, and saying, I think one of his famous quotes was he preferred tinned salmon to smoked salmon, was born out partly from a keen sense of how the winds were changing in the late 1950s and 1960s. The fact that you know working class pop stars like the Beatles, a working class actor like Sean Connery, and working class playwrights like John Osborne and Alan Sillitoe were incredibly popular, meant that by 1960, really, being working class was seen as incredibly progressive, incredibly positive and classless thing, and in part because the government of the day was dominated by people like Harold Macmillan and Alec Douglas Hume. The irony is that both Macmillan and Hume did fairly good jobs of managing to kind of steer the ship of Britain throughout the 1950s and early 60s. And much of the prosperity that gave people the leisure time, the wealth in which to dabble with ideas of classlessness, was in part down to them. So Wilson was a great at adopting things and images, themes and images that sounded good, that presented a kind of a positive spin on things. The substance of it all is rather weaker. And I think, unfortunately, the verdict, I guess for me really, is that what Wilson did was he put himself first. He was the careerist whose ability to avoid the essential but unpleasant, and to sabotage, again, essential but unpopular things, like in place of strife, meant that much of what Wilson hoped to achieve didn't happen, and that he stored up for future British governments a toxic legacy for the 1970s. Okay, so I hope that's useful. There may be people out there doing British history. It's very much flavour of the month at the moment. If so, stay tuned in the next week or so. I'm going to do a little bit more on Britain in the 60s and 70s. And the Explaining History book review is coming up shortly. We've just launched The Genocidal Century by Julia Routledge. Download it. It's a great read. It gives you a brilliant overview in concise form of 20th century genocide. And two new titles that are on the way are Gina Bolter's After Mao and Tyrell Eskelson's The American Century. So that's the third part of our Century series. So stay in touch for those, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.